Greetings, everyone, and welcome to season three of the Battery Ventures Sound Bites podcast, the series where we tackle all things go to market. We have an exciting season coming up, but today we have a special episode. It's a personal one for me because we get to speak with someone I had the pleasure of working with previously, Joe Chernoff. Most recently, Chief Marketing Officer of Pendo, where we worked shoulder to shoulder for several years. But before Pendo, Joe built a world-class marketing resume, stops at Eloqua, at HubSpot, at Insight Squared. And most recently, Joe has saddled up with me again, joining Battery Ventures as our executive in residence, essentially serving as our in-house marketing expert. So welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Bill. And a very special episode. When we were growing up, always meant that like something spectacular was going to happen in that particular one. So let's see if we can live up to the very special billing.
Let's earn it. So listen, Joe, I'll tell you this to start. 9 out of the 10 voices in my head are telling me to follow some of the prompts that we shared prior to this podcast. But I'm going to listen to that one voice and go a little off script here.
All right, go for it.
Let's talk about beards for a moment. Help our audience understand, how long has this journey been? Why didn't you go with the pointed and not the flat cut? And like ZZ Top, do you ever see yourself cutting it, or is it so embodied in your persona now that it has to stay?
I think everyone needs a shtick, and it's sort of my shtick. I shaved it once, and my son had a breakdown. He was really displeased with what my face looked like, apparently. And then when we were at Pendo, I made a bet that I would shave my beard if we hit a certain number. And my son asked me every day how we were performing against that number. So it did like kind of pull him into SaaS metrics. And he was rooting against us making our quarter. And so I decided I did not want to have conflicting rooting interests. So I never made that wager again internally. I went with the beard, just the point, because I like the shape better. And it, as my mother said, it's a little bit devilish.
That is indeed a fitting description of what I know about you. So thanks, Mom, for coming in with that. All right. Well, good. Thanks for humoring me with that. It's always good to get warmed up on one of these with something a little personal and let the audience get to know you. So I think we've just accomplished that. So let's actually dive into some of the prompts we shared about. First one's an obvious place to begin is, for the last 3 months or so, you've been working inside of a venture capital firm after a 30 plus year career in software. Curiosity of if you're seeing or recognizing any patterns out there on what companies want to speak to you about.
I am, and it's not what I expected. So like, let's go back, you and I, a few months. We were talking about me joining, and I said, is everybody going to want to talk to me about their funnel metrics and, you know, what stage to stage conversion should look like and where they're off? And you were like, now and then, yes, but I don't think that's going to be the bulk of the question. I did. And you were right. It hasn't been. Most of the companies I've talked to want to know how they can break from a pack. What can they do to have an outsized presence? What can they do to put a little daylight between them and the rest of the competitors? You know, every space is so crowded and that competition is so intense that everybody is looking for some edge that they can have. That tends to be what most of the conversations are.
It's fantastic. It goes back to your mom's devilish comment here. You finding something different to go help these organizations with. So in that break from the pack, has there been an area? Is it something around the demand gen area? Is it something around the messaging and product marketing message area? Is there been any pattern that you've seen there?
No, not specifically there, but it's not about demand gen. I talked to one company the other day that said, my pipeline looks great. What I want to know is how I can get the world to know us. The ratio between our presence in the market and our ARR is off. Our ARR is bigger than we are. And so there's not specific pattern about how to break away. Some want to talk about product marketing and message. Some want to talk about a second product and how that second product can get the same momentum as their first product. Some want to talk about brand and awareness and like stunts and how to do something to like get noticed. There's some distribution in the how, but there's a lot of consistency around what they're trying to do. And what they're trying to do is stand out.
That's great. You know, I ran over this in our intro and failed to introduce myself for new listeners, but my name is Bill Binch, and I'm an operating partner at Battery. And what I do inside of Battery is focus on the sales and the growth side of the house. That's my background as a former CRO. And Joe is the same type of role, but focused on the marketing area. And Joe, to take your answers there of the patterns, an interesting element that I've recognized in my little over 3 years here at Battery is I had 29 years of operating experience, and then I moved to a financial services company. And what I find myself doing inside of the roles, inside of the companies that I work with, is similar to what you said, which is they're looking for a way to break out, a way to create a little daylight between them and their competitive set of companies. And what I find I'm talking about a lot of times is a mashup of, number one, my 29 years of experience, but number two, the patterns and the perspectives I've seen happen over the last 3 years. This is a really unique perch in that I get to speak with 20 or 30 companies, probably a quarter, and get to listen in for what's working and also what blockers or brick walls that those companies are running into.
Yeah, we talked about this recently. I had my first call where I was able to sort of summon pattern from what I had been hearing from other battery companies and apply it to that conversation. And it felt like this sort of milestone moment where I wasn't just looking at a data set of one, my personal experience, but really drawing from this exposure. And it felt really good. And it was really validating for the advice I was giving, because it wasn't just about me and what I had done. It was about a larger set and a larger trend.
It's so true. I mean, I wish there was a one-size-fits-all playbook for most of these topics that you tackle. But the reality is that models evolve, competition grows faster, we change, we grow, you have to incorporate the company culture. So I wish I could walk in, and I get asked all the time, for example, should we have an AE and an AM model, or should we have just one AE that sells both? And like I said, I wish I could just say, like, this is the answer. But the fact is, there is no one size playbook. So I agree with what you're saying there around the experiential level. It's great to tie together your past experience and the things that you have seen work, and combine it with what you're hearing is happening in real time out there in the market now.
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate credibility.
Me as well. All right. So Joe, you mentioned this a few minutes ago that we talked about this role, you coming into Battery for months and months. And one thing that stood out to me in that whole process of talking with you was some of your thought process that was unique. And one of those unique thought processes was this streetlight concept. You have a very distinct and unique point of view of the role of marketing. And it was something that I'd never heard before or seen somebody really express. So that seems like an obvious thing that I think our listeners would be really excited to hear you share a little bit about.
Yeah, happy to. And it's actually come in handy because it relates directly to the question that I'm being asked most often, which is, how do I break from the pack? So the streetlight effect is, I think it's a parable, and it's a story that goes something like this. There's a drunk on his hands and knees under a streetlight looking for something along the side of the road. A police officer walks past, sees the guy, asks what he's doing. He says, I'm looking for my watch. The cop helps him look for his watch. After a while, it's clear they're not going to find it, and says to the guy, where did you drop it? The guy points and says, oh, over there. He said, well, why are we looking here? And the guy says, well, this is where the light is. So here's how it relates to marketing. As CMOs, we tend to operate directly under the streetlight. And the streetlight for us is things that are measurable. So we tend to run programs that are the best programs of the measurable set. And so we look in this narrow band of programs that lend themselves directly to the way we're measured, to the KPIs that we're measured on. And we ignore everything outside of that scope, or at least we minimize everything outside of the light that the street lamp's casting. And as a result, like, we have this finite set of activity that all companies are doing, and because most of the distribution channels are dynamic marketplaces, we're driving up the prices on one another. And because we're all doing the same programs, or at least very similar programs, we are kind of saturating our audiences with lookalike programs, and we all start to sound the same. But it all stems from something I say all the time, which is show me how I measure and I'll show you how I behave. When we're all measured in such similar ways, we end up all behaving in very similar ways.
So a parable, let's learn from that one. If you were speaking with a CMO today and you shared with them the streetlight effect concept, is the advice you have to do what is underneath the light, the measurable KPIs and that stuff, but also find your outside the light space? Or is it eschew the streetlight stuff or minimize the streetlight stuff and focus outside?
It's a good question. It has to be both. Your first job is to keep your job. And as long as you're measured in certain ways, you do have to deliver on those KPIs. The irony here is many of the activities outside of the streetlight will have a positive impact on those measurable programs you're running. I'll give you an example because I know this is like awfully abstract. When I was at Pendo, we ran this program where we created custom Nikes, and we had this like well-known sneaker designer hand paint these sneakers. And the only rule I gave him was it can't have a Pendo logo on it. I guess it's two rules. It can't have a Pendo logo on it. And it has to look like something that I would buy on StockX or on the secondary market. It has to look desirable. And then I wrote to a bunch of influencers, like really, really influential people, because sneakers were expensive. And I asked them their shoe size. And I thought that like an email that was asking somebody their shoe size would be provocative enough that it would get a response, and it did. So I have this back and forth with one guy who was kind of puzzled by the program. Of course, he was a size 10 and wanted his sneakers. He ends our exchange by saying, how are you going to measure this? And I said, I'm not. And he said, well, how are you going to prove it worked? And I said, I'm not. I'm just going to trust that it's going to work. And he wrote, good luck with that. And that's how it ended. So fast forward 6 weeks, we're prepping for our board meeting. And we're all talking about our stories from the quarter and successes and things that we wish we had done better. And the sales leader says we had this bluebird. A bluebird is better than anyone, Bill. It's a deal that just shows up in your pipeline that you weren't counting on. There was no way to kind of predict it. And we had this bluebird that was 5x our normal deal size. And it just showed up in our pipeline. And so I asked, well, like, is there any story? What can we learn from this? He said, all I know is our contact went to this workshop. And at that workshop, the guy that ran the workshop said, you could replace your entire product operations team with Pendo. Well, I think you can see where this is going. That guy was the very guy that expressed skepticism over this program. That workshop happened 3 weeks after our exchange. So if I never happened to be in that meeting where we were prepping for the board conversation, or if the CRO had never like told this story about this bluebird, or I never thought to ask the follow-up question, is there anything we know about this company? I would have never known this connection, but it would have made it no less true that program led to this bluebird. Some things we just have to trust.
This is a great story. This is a great story. I'll relate it to something in my history. When I was in college finishing, I had a professor that I really liked, and he gave his advice to me. He said, Bill, there are no traffic jams in the extra mile. Do you know what that means? And I said, I think it means do the extra mile. Just like if you're at the gym, do those 5 extra pushups. If you're a telemarketer, make those 5 extra calls, like go the extra mile. He goes, yeah, that's part of it. But Joe, very similar to what you just said, he said, you got to go the first mile to get to the second mile. And so when you go get your first job out of college, make sure you're really, really good at that first job. And I think you essentially just drove that home with Mr. Size 10 on the shoes coming in there.
By the way, I was a telemarketer in college. I don't think we ever talked about this. And the only time I was in sales, I was a telemarketer in college for a frozen foods company trying to sell frozen foods, but really we're selling freezers. And they would listen in on the calls. And I got fired. Great. They listened in the call and they said, Joe, you're trying to sell. Stop begging people. And so I knew I was not going to be great at sales when I was begging people to get my frozen foods.
But a learning process, so part of the first mile, right? You went mile zero. Mile zero is getting your foot in the door and do that. All right. So I definitely want to tackle the topic of AI in the marketing world, but I want to pause on that for a second because the streetlight concept, I want to stay there for a moment, that you said you do both. And I think that's the important part of the extra miles. You have to do the first mile, but then you also have to find your extra mile, your size 10 guy that can come and be an influencer for you getting something done later down the line. So I'm always very curious when I speak with folks that have led the marketing function about their interpretation of the modern marketing org and what that looks like. So I'd love to ask a few questions there because it's going to back into some things that I think that you should. It'll back into measurement. It'll back into some things that I think that people listening to this podcast will be curious to get your take on. So let me ask a couple questions, but let me set the foundation. Let's say, Joe, you decide you go back to another software company as the head of marketing. And just for sake of setting some context, it's a $10 million ARR company that just received $30 million in new funding. So it's clearly probably got some momentum. It's got some product market fit, and clearly someone's believing in the vision of this. And you get to go build the marketing team. Here are the questions I'd love to tap into your brain on what the modern marketing org looks like. The first one would be, what are the key roles? Like, you get to wave your magic wand here and bring in the organization. What do you think is critical in today's marketing team?
Talk to a battery portfolio company. And I really liked the CMO. We've chatted about him. And we talked about this role that he calls a stitcher. Think of it as a half ops, half growth hacker in the era of AI. It's somebody that runs tests with AI tools, stitches them together for data to flow between and among them, and constantly experiments with ways to have AI tools essentially be his manager level workforce. And so the first role I would look for is that sort of technical, opsy, hackery marketer that can take some of the headcount burden out of the organization and use AI tools, you know, to produce first pass at content, to possibly get campaigns off the ground, to respond to warm leads in a way that allows me to be much more surgical about hiring. Like, I'd want to hire an editor, not a team of writers. If AI is the writer, then I need an editor that makes the AI language feel more human, feel more on brand, right? And so that would be the first role I would hire. Then I would surround them with an editor. I'd probably have a design head, but not a design team. And it's that person's role to use AI to produce first pass at design, just like the writing, and then refine it and make it on brand for us. And there would be a similar function in demand gen, a demand gen person that uses AI as that first pass at a junior level team beneath them. A lot of directors, not a lot of managers.
This is terrific. I'm just excited to hear this because I think this is what across any function, doesn't have to just be marketing, but across any function, I think a lot of the functional leaders are trying to figure out what their org structure is going to look like, especially with what I'd say the transition from experimentation with AI to the operationalization of AI. And I think that your org structure is really unique from that perspective. I haven't heard that take from you. I haven't heard that take from anybody else, but I think what it's doing is bending some of the current org structure and adjusting those. I mean, I think what you just said there about the editor versus the creator is really interesting, is you want the editor because you know that AI is capable of creating really good content, but you want to be able to, it sounds like, make that authentic and personalized.
Yeah, agreed.
That's great. So a question I ask every CMO that comes onto the podcast, and this goes back to your streetlight concept. How do you measure this modern definition of a marketing team?
Post AI, pre AI? I actually think the answer is the same. You have to generate pipe. Like that's a non-negotiable. And all I'm saying outside of the streetlight is still in service of creating pipeline, right? I didn't supply those sneakers because I wanted to get in the footwear business, right? There was an end game. And so it still is pipeline, pre-AI, post-AI. The means of getting there may be a little bit different, right? And so I think that's what I think ultimately everything needs to germinate from pipe. Now, if you're asking, what do I report to the board? Is it just pipeline? I would say no. It still is sort of pipeline centric, but I think you have to say to the board, do you have enough pipeline? Is the demand you're creating performing as expected? Is the pipe you've created performing as expected? And are you doing this in a way that is within your cost parameters as a business, or are your costs going up? Is there something to worry about on the economic side of the go-to-market? So it's still pipe, but I think you have to give the board one or two generations removed from the absolute pipeline number so that they can have confidence or concerns moving into the out quarters. I would love your answer to this question. Something I've asked myself going into board meetings sometimes is, what is better, missing a number but knowing why, or hitting a number but not knowing why?
It's a great question. Intellectually, missing the number and understanding why says that you at least have ball control over your business. And I think that would be more valuable in the long run. I think hitting the number is obviously always important. And it always seems like when you're working at a company that this is the most important quarter, whether it's the Q4 or it's the quarter you're out raising money, or, you know, you're trying to like achieve something so you can hire some future roles. So obviously it's always important. But I think a board member would look at that and say, I really like working with leaders, go-to-market leaders, product leaders that understand why something is happening inside of their business. And in fact, if you've listened to this podcast before, I've talked about this concept. In the role of operating partner, I'm in the fortunate position of seeing a lot of board decks. I occasionally attend and watch board meetings themselves. And one thing that I've recognized that I think is a really mature way of displaying that kind of ball control that you just asked about, Joe, is I love when the marketer comes in, and remember, it's a deck, it's a board deck, it's not like one slide, but they come in and they answer the specific comment that you called out there, which is, do we have the right amount of pipeline to make our number? Meaning, was the ship already sunk before it left the docks? And the marketer being able to stand up and say, we were above what we need, at what we needed, or below what we needed, is, I think, a really mature view. And then the sales leader, that man or woman comes in and they talk about, did we convert that pipe above, at, or below the right rate? And I've seen this happen many times where the sales leader and the marketing leader come in and they have this conversation. And it's just so mature because neither one's down in the engine room of MQLs and leads and sales isn't over and we have this much at this stage and this stage and that stage. They're talking about the running of the business of go to market. So short answer is, I would say, you know, I'd rather have a team that missed for a quarter and understood why, so that they know maybe some of the motions they have to do to be able to fix it and get themselves to a make position.
I totally agree. I think if you hit it and don't know why, you probably got lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, like that might be great for that one quarter, but at some point that's probably also where you hear about the person has like hit the ceiling of the role that they're in, is that they're failing to grow and understand why. So that's great. That's great stuff. All right. So you brought in AI as I walked through that question. So let's talk a little bit more about the impact of AI on the marketing function. You mentioned about your Stitcher role, this half ops, half kind of hacker type of thing. What other opinions do you have about like a big open question for you, Joe, like what other opinions do you have about where AI will change the marketing function?
I mean, where won't it, I guess, is the real question. Here is where I'm hopeful for AI's value. I am hopeful that AI solves attribution. I think attribution has created this sort of Frankenstein in marketing where it's the streetlight, right? We run programs that the attribution model recognizes as valuable. And therefore, we begin to serve the model and not necessarily the business in all cases, right? We're trying to get credit. Attribution is the credit-giving machine. And it's often like human-defined. I remember I was in a meeting with you, and you'll remember this more clearly than I because it was something you said that I didn't. But marketing was presenting on attribution or on lead scoring, which is precursor to attribution. And the points that we were assigning, and points equaled value, to different activities, you asked like, well, why is that 5 points and that 10 points? And the answer you got was kind of like, well, because we think that's worth 5 and that's worth 10. It was arbitrary. And while attribution models aren't as arbitrary as that particular instance, they are human defined. And so that means they have bias in them. And it means that they're like kind of limited in the scope. Right? Just a person decided to weight something greater than something else. My hope is that AI will see much further than the human eye can see into all of the types of engagements that a prospect has and an account has with a business and be able to dynamically weight those engagements such that we don't really know what levers to pull to like get more credit or to avoid getting blamed. And it just simply characterizes accurately who is generating business for this company and to what extent. And if we can get that in place, if we can get a dispassionate attribution model in place, I think that it will cast a wider streetlight. It will open up the door for marketers to experiment more because they won't be serving just a handful of scoreboards. That's an area I hope AI helps in.
That would be a great unlock out there because of what you just said. Like we all talk about the friction between marketing and sales, and a lot of the friction is over like, well, I created that versus you created that. And it's so at some point irrelevant. I mean, it's a metric that I think you want to measure so you understand and can also set some targets, but you're right. It's still very arbitrary.
And it's zero sum. I mean, these should be percentages. It shouldn't be so absolute, and they're very absolute, the models.
That'll be interesting. A few weeks from now when this podcast publishes and anybody watches it that's trying to tackle that problem, I can imagine there's going to be a bunch of inbound flow coming into you or me.
Hey, I'll take the call.
I would be interested in that. All right, that's great. All right, another question relative to AI. You, along your career journey, had the opportunity to work at two really well-known demand gen companies, Eloqua and HubSpot. As you think about AI versus the workflows that we had in that space, 10, 12 years ago, if you think about the AI generation of that, whether it is HubSpot doing it or a new upstart, where do you see that category evolving to?
I think those workflows that, we used to say you only need one person to do, and then eventually you needed a team to do, I think a machine will do those. I think that's automatable. And I think that category goes away. I think marketers used marketing automation because they had to, not because they wanted to. And it sort of became a necessary evil, right? It's a lot of overhead, a lot of complexity, a lot of bloat in the products. And I think a lot of that goes away, if not all of that goes away. I think HubSpot has a chance to redefine the category and be one of the rare incumbent that is also the innovator. And that's on the back of Dharmesh. I mean, Dharmesh is he's just a genius and he's indefatigable. Like he still posts as enthusiastically on LinkedIn about tech as he ever has. He just loves it and you can feel it. And I think on the back of Dharmesh, they have a chance to be an innovator and an incumbent. Outside of that, you know, it's going to be a AI first product that just redefines the whole space.
Got it. And you're right. We had Dharmesh Shah come speak at Cloud New York as our keynote a couple of years ago. And he had this incredible skill set of taking really complex concepts and distilling them down into something really simple and relatable for the audience. So I like your predictions there. That space, that category goes away or shifts dramatically as AI takes over in that. All right, well, last question in this category for you around the impact of AI on marketing. The SDR concept, this is another one of those things that a lot like attribution, does it live with marketing? Does it live with sales? That's not the question I have for you today. My question is SDRs. Do you think, much like the marketing or the demand gen space, do you think SDRs continue to exist, or is this like fait accompli that these guys are going away?
I think the SDR manager continues to exist, and the SDR manager manages agents. I once bought BDR.ai and SDR.ai, and I foolishly sold them. I regret that now. I think that role was always susceptible to AI because it's a repetitive task that requires constant optimization of messaging, and it's susceptible to human bias. I get a good response from this email. I'm going to keep sending it, even though that was an N equals one response. Very susceptible to human biases. And it requires like a lot of busy work to get one email out the door. And AI can replace that busy work, right? And so I think that there will be a human being that is responsible for managing agents. I don't think that's far off. I think it's 18 months off.
Joe, this is one of my favorite podcasts because you are projecting so many things forward and putting a point of view out there, right? And like, we all know that like we have experience and that we're trying to project out, but I'm loving soaking this up of hearing how you think about it. I also think that role is in for a lot of evolution, you know, and that's as a person that was I started my career as an SDR, and then I hired SDRs and built what I thought, you know, I tried to make was a really great track for training my future sales reps and create, like, with the use of demand gen tools, the most efficient process out there. And today I look at it and I say, where we're going with AI, this role is going to change. And I really bifurcate it between inbound and outbound first. I think inbound, like you said, in the next 18 months, I agree with your concept. I think that role can largely probably go away or diminish because I think that buyers are much more trained today than they were 5 years ago. And 5 years ago, they were much more trained than 5 years before that. And so they're coming in educated. And if I'm educated, realistically, do I want to go through that arduous process? If I'm looking to buy a new piece of software and I'm going to reach out to three different companies, do I want to talk to three different BDRs who are going to qualify me and then put me to three different AEs who are going to re-ask the same questions that the SDR did the day before just to get to the demo? No, there's a much more direct path. And I do think that, you know, me at least as a forward-looking technologist, I look at it from the perspective of bring it on, bring on the new technologies. I mean, and I always use the analogy, like when Uber came out, it was like, oh, this is kind of a novel idea, but at least it was a black car limousine or a black car SUV that I was jumping into, a professional driver. Then this UberX concept came out and it was like, wait, that's this guy Joe and his Toyota Camry eating a turkey sandwich up front, like driving around. This is kind of weird. Well, today, all I take is UberX. Why? Because I've grown accustomed and I've softened my boundaries on that. So from that perspective, I do think.
And free sandwiches.
And free sandwiches. Exactly. Good. Thanks for that point of view. All right. A few other questions here. Another hot potato topic. We talked about where AI will impact. We talked about the future of demand gen. We talked about SDRs. But another area that gets often talked about in the go-to-market, the broader go-to-market definition, is the role of revenue operations, right? Something that started as sales ops. And then you called it out. We used to say in marketing, you need to hire one person. It became a marketing ops team. And then you even have like customer success ops over here. So you have these like wide swath of people that support these functions. And as we've seen in the last, I don't know, 7-8 years, we've seen an umbrella come form over that called revenue operations. I'm curious your opinion. Does it work? when all sales, marketing, and CS ops report into one person? And the corollary to that question is, where, if you were a CEO running a company, would you report it?
I think it should report to one person. And I think there are redundancies in ops skills when you have like a thin group of just marketing ops people and one is on vacation, like email stops for that week, right? But when ops is like revenue ops, and it can be customer ops, sales, marketing, when it's a group, you have some redundancy, right? You have some failover that helps you keep the motion of go-to-market moving, even when key pieces are unavailable. I also think that it shouldn't be under the revenue leader or the marketing leader, because I don't really want the revenue leader to put his or her thumb on the scale of my marketing ops or prioritize sales ops hiring over marketing ops hiring. And I don't want that responsibility myself to make the determination that I want to hire a marketing ops person and then shortchange my CRO, something that they want. I feel like it should be in a neutral corner, and that corner should be under the CFO. It should be under somebody that's in a very orderly position, that is obviously economically minded, that's thinking about efficiencies in the business, because ultimately that's what ops is there to create. And it's a neutral corner. It's a third person involved in the decision making. And then it's not marketing versus sales and making these trade-off choices. There's a third person in the room. I think that's where it should belong.
Yeah, it's interesting that you have that point of view. You share that with Phil Fernandez, the old CEO of Marketo. I saw him speak at Saster. It was probably 7 years ago. And the question was, it was actually a whole presentation on if you were to do it over again, what 10 things would you do differently? And this was one of them. He said, I unfortunately allowed the proliferation of the marketing ops, the sales ops, the CS ops. And it was a bunch of fiefdoms that you know, would wrestle over ownership of Salesforce and your CRM, or would wrestle over ownership of just workflows. And he said that didn't work that great. And so his answer was he would put it underneath either a CRO that ran all of the functions. So yeah, than just the marketing leader or just the sales leader, but a CRO or president, whatever title, or a CFO. So someone that has all the dogs in the race, and that would be the CRO, or the CFO who, like you said, is dispassionate and just wants the company to work as efficiently as possible.
I think the other reason under a CFO it makes sense is, you know, ops is the intersection point of a lot of tools and technologies and data providers. And it forces the CFO to really understand not only the tech stack, but the way data is procured and flows through that tech stack. And so I believe we didn't have this at Pendo. I did have it in the structure at Insight Squared. I believe it helps the CFO become a partner in technology purchasing. Excellent. Rather than a situation where you have to kind of convince the CFO of a new tool you need.
It's a good call out. The interesting note that I'd make on this topic is today's head of sales seems much more data-driven, much more analytical to me than the old school kind of knuckle-dragging, quota-carrying Neanderthal that like went out and like just slammed the big deal down. And so, you know, what I'll note is in my last couple of operating roles, my chief of staff, if you will, was my rev ops person. I was going to that person daily, like whether via Slack or email or text or even smoke signals, I was communicating with that person nonstop. And one of the realizations I had while at Pendo was, you know what I'm really good at? I'm really good at this quota carrying thing. And so I had my quota carriers, my small business, my mid-market business leader, my enterprise leader. I had channel or partner. I had Europe. I had Asia. I had those things. And I really wanted those to report to me because that was my wheelhouse strength. But then I had all these other functions off to the side, like sales engineering, SDRs, sales operations, sales enablement, all these different areas that I probably wasn't as expert in. And I wanted to have a single person that reported to me that operated all those. And this is, like I said, probably 6-7 years ago. It was a hard role to go fill because those are like 3 or 4 or 5 very different disciplines in the sales organization. And most people haven't grown. So I had to find the right person. But I did like that model that I had the quota carriers and I had one person hanging off that ran the business that was all shared across those different quota carrying leaders.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll reach a point where, almost like in sports, where not every great coach was a former professional player. And we'll reach a point that the head of revenue in an organization never carried a bag. They are an ops person or a great enablement person that has risen to the head of revenue, but they themselves never had a number.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing more and more, like if I looked at LinkedIn, I see more and more of the direction leaning that way. Back to my earlier statement of there's no one size fits all playbook. I do think there's some nuance in that scenario, depending on what the product is and who it sells to, that would direct, or said another way, would make it easier for some areas for that to happen and harder in other ones to happen. But it's a great question. I should have put that in here, but you kind of just reversed it and asked it. So thanks for that. All right. On building a bond with sales, this is something, Joe, you've done over and over in your career. You've either entered an organization as the new guy that's leading marketing and you need to go create that bond with the sales leader, or you've been in seat and a new sales leader comes in and you need to complete or create that simpatico between the two teams. Any tips and sharings that you have from doing that over your career?
Yeah, and I have not batted 1,000, that's for sure. I think, look, one of them came from you, and you were no surprises person, right? Like, you and I could have a hard conversation before the group meeting, but once we get in the group meeting, I am not to surprise you with any like new data or any new concern or any anecdote you haven't heard yet. And it wasn't that we were in cahoots. It was that we just didn't want to put one another on our heel in that meeting. At the very least, let's not do that. And it wasn't long after we had an interim at Pendo where I got surprised in a meeting. And I wrote the person and said, hey, never do that again. No surprises. And we talked about it after. And he was like, hey, you just helped me be a better sales leader. I really appreciate that. So no surprises is kind of rule number one. And if you violate that, rule number two doesn't matter because you've really lost some trust there. Rule number two, I think, is if you think of the Venn diagram of what a CMO is responsible for and what a CRO is responsible for, there's a healthy intersection between the two. I've always sort of informally looked at it as I will accept public responsibility for everything that is exclusively in my circle or is at the intersection between the two of us. If it's a jump ball between the two of us, I'll take it. Now, separately, usually that'll result in a call like, hey, thanks for having my back on that. I know this is both of us. I appreciate you like kind of jumping on that grenade there. I think if you do those two things, you accept responsibility, even when you only own partial responsibility, you accept full responsibility, and you never surprise your partner, I think you can weather storms of not delivering enough pipeline or your MQL numbers tanked or the SDR team is going to get transitioned from one group to another and there's some debate about it. All of that other kind of day-to-day hassle, those day-to-day, I don't want to call them conflicts, but those day-to-day points of contentious decision-making, difficult decision-making, all of those get a lot easier when you know the person will accept responsibility if it goes wrong. And when you know that there's nothing that's going to be said in the meeting that catches you off guard.
I really like that. I subscribe. I try to, I should say, because none of us bat 1,000 to the no surprises. And you said something really distinct there. You said that he came back and said, thank you, you'll make me a better sales leader. Joe, I would submit you helped make him a better leader, not his function role, but just as a leader, because I always, like, you were part of my forecast program. My forecast call was a buildup where there was a cadence where, you know, a day before we had the forecast call, the sales reps had to submit their forecast, then the frontline managers, then the next line managers. Why? Because it gave me some time to be able to review what had changed week over week. And it gave me time to go project that out. And as you know, you were invited to sit on the forecast call. Our CEO was, our CFO was. And that was more, quite honestly, because I didn't want to have to spend 30 minutes with each one of you after the forecast call, reiterating what had just happened on the forecast call. Let's just all do it at once. But my goal was always to go into that meeting knowing where things were at and not like have it be like a pop-up meeting where it's like, oh, I didn't know that we lost that deal or something like that. And you're right. It's not about being in cahoots or like manufacturing what it's going to be. It's about like being on top of your business. And that to me is just good leadership. So I really like your perspective on building a bond with sales there. Thanks for sharing that. All right, a couple of other topics and then we'll call it a wrap. But just kind of curious, a couple of highlight questions for you here. You've been in some very competitive spaces. You've grown your professional career in some spaces where there's some knockdown, drag out kind of competition, winner take all kind of mentality on that. I'm curious, as you look back and think about a really great marketing program that you've been a part of, either your team came up and you were able to oversee or something that you lit the spark on, that something, what was it? And what makes it memorable? Was it the program was so innovative and outside the streetlight? Or was it that the results it drove just far exceeded expectations? Something like that, an edgy marketing move that you've made.
Well, some of the best ones weren't edgy. They were just good. I'll give you an edgy one. I don't think it worked all that well, but it was edgy. Knockdown, drag them out category. And we took out this ad that was it was an excerpt from an email we received about, and deep in the chain was a message about a competitor that just said, company X is bad. Don't use them. And we literally just took a screenshot of the email, blurred out the sender's name, and turned it into an ad and put that on LinkedIn. And we got a cease and desist on that one. But I thought that was edgy and fun. And it was honest. Like, that was an email we received. Some campaigns that were effective. Look, I think that Pendo's Pendemonium, one, is the best name ever for a conference. Todd Olson came up with the name, not me. But that conference was like culturally invigorating for the team. It's customers and prospects rubbing shoulders with each other, having fun. Like, it was always it was a festival. We tried to make it a festival. And it didn't feel like a conference. And we had like, there was just so much goodness that came out. It was such compounding value that came out of that event. That's something I was really proud to be part of every year. And it's something I'm really going to miss. I think the HubSpot podcast was something I was really proud of. We had one goal. We want to be a top three business podcast in 6 months. That was the goal. And not only did we do that, but it launched Dave Gearhart's career. He was the one that I hired to build and run that podcast. And he became a really prominent marketer on the back of just showing so much hustle to get that thing out the door. There was only one dud of an episode, and it was the one I hosted. And my God, I did such a bad job in this. I think they like pulled it. It was so bad. Something else that I was proud of, I was at an early stage company. And we were moving from the CIC in Cambridge. The CIC was like a floor in this building all for startups, Cambridge Incubation Center or something. And we had space in the CIC and we were moving to our own office in Boston. And we had a CEO that thought that we should get press that we were opening our own office. I didn't think we should get press that we were opening our own office, but he was my boss and he was really passionate about this. So the way we solved it was, this goes back a few years, Game of Thrones was a popular show at the time. And it began with this like map of all the kingdoms. And so we created a Game of Thrones visual map that showed all of the companies that were in that had moved from Cambridge to Boston. And it showed all the startups in Boston because Cambridge was seen as the hub for startups, but Cambridge was getting expensive. So they were moving into Boston. And it was all the startups in Boston that were formerly in Cambridge. And we published that. And the Boston Globe Sunday Business section did their own version of the map that was all of the startups in the Boston ecosystem and how they got there. And they wrote in the article, like, this was brought to you, like, this came from this company. The company's name was Convey that had done this research. And all the companies that were in the map were glad to be included in the map. And so they started to share it. And it became a thing for a little while.
That's great.
I was happy with that. That was fun.
Oh, well, you took us through edgy, effective, and then fun. Doesn't get better than that. I mean, it's interesting. It'd be great to sit at a conference with CMOs one time and have that question come out, which is, you know, what's the edgiest, what's the most impactful, and what's the funnest one you've ever done, and to go through that. All right, you're taking us to a good place. Let me close with this one. You, like myself, have worked for a number of companies, roles of individual and then growing your career, ones where you had the title, ones where you were building to get the title. If you were to put on your Hall of Fame hat for one of the companies that you've worked for, what would it be and why?
If there were a Hall of Fame, I would be just happy to be there. I think I have to wear the Eloqua hat. I think that I wouldn't be here now if I hadn't worked at Eloqua under Brian Carden and Joe Payne at that time in the company's history, and I wasn't given such a long leash to do all the things that I wanted to do. And it wasn't, you know, it was at this transformation point where, like, marketing was sort of growing up. And so much of this was just good fortune. And I think I made something of the good fortune, but I was really lucky to be in that company, in that space at that time. And I don't know if I did my best work there, but I think I had the biggest impact on a company in that period of time, just because the stars aligned. And so I think I'd wear that hat.
That's not surprising to me. Well, so I'll tell you this. My answer would be Marketo, which is where you and I met. And what I'd add to that answer, my answer is very similar to yours, is I think there I was probably at the prime of my career from an energy perspective, combined with I had been trained really well. I'd had some great mentors. And it was time for me to, like, to own the baton, you know, to be able to run with it. But I think an interesting element for our listeners to hear is when I was at Pendo, you were an advisor. And then Todd, the CEO, approached me and said, I've always wanted to have Joe in Pendo. I've always wanted to work with him. But I know the two of you were across the table from each other, him at Eloqua, you at Marketo. And I know that both of you are pretty passionate, and it may have been even personal. And so I don't want to make this move if it's going to create a lot of breakage, but I want you to know my wishes. My wishes are to have Joe in here. So I'd like you to go talk. And I remember that interview with you, Joe. I remember we scheduled a longer than normal period because I think in our exchange or email, we said, look, let's not be time constrained to maybe talk all this through. And I remember we got on, and in the first 20 minutes, it was gritty. Like, it was you and I both being pretty real and saying, like, look, like, this is how I felt about you on the other side of the street, and you saying the same things back, and me hearing probably some feedback I'd never heard. And I remember working through that whole process. And I remember the end of the call, like, you know, note to all marketers here, this was an ultimate close. You said, look, Bill, I'm self-aware enough to know that if we hang up this phone call and you go back to Todd and say, I don't think this is going to work, that this probably doesn't come together. So I'm curious to know, how do you think this call has gone to put us back onto, or put us onto the same page? And what I recollect was my answer was something along the lines of, Joe, I'm going to go tell Todd that I think this can work because I respect what you've done. I just happen to be on the other side of the receiving end of it. And that wasn't always comfortable. I think that you're super effective at what you could do. And I think that you and I have shown the ability that we can lay our personal, like, or professional grievances aside and be able to make this work. And then obviously it moved forward and you came and joined. And I remember your first day coming on the job of you and I going to get together at the end of the day and breaking bread together. So kind of a fun story, but so a little extension of what you asked there. the Marketo years were, like you said, I don't think I would have evolved to what I accomplished without those years. It was not only that, it was 10 years of an incredible run. You know, you named out Joe Payne and Brian and yours, that CEO, super impactful on helping me teach, helping me grow, helping me learn, and him being a teacher. And so other than my parents, I'd say that he was probably the most impactful coach or mentor or leader that I've had the chance to work with. And that learning is just, that's an incredible. If you get into a role that you can do that and be on a learning journey like that, I was able to be there, that would be it for, and that's why I'd put that hat on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And look, it's a community now. There's nobody from the marketing automation early days community that won't pick up the phone if somebody else from that community calls them. You know, I post on LinkedIn and Phil Fernandez is responding. We were arch rivals. He called Joe Payne once and said, fire Joe Chernoff, right? We were as arch rivals as you could be. And now here we are, like, you know, picking each other up with posts and supporting each other. It became a real community.
It really did. I have a lot of stories on that, but I'll save those for another podcast, perhaps. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for coming on. Number one, really excited to have you inside of Battery Ventures, working alongside shoulder to shoulder with me yet again on helping the battery companies. That's been a really great add to our arsenal, but also great just to have you, like I said earlier, come on the podcast here and help project out of where the space is going. So I'm really interested to all the listeners, your comments and the feedback that you provide based on Joe's prognostications here inside of our sound bites today. So Joe, thanks for joining.
Bill, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Take care.